I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Ballot 2012 on Intersection. In Orange County's District 3, former County Administrator Pete Clark and former Orange County Commissioner Louis Damiani are scrapping for a seat on the Board of County Commissioners. In this installment of our week-long political series, both candidates talk about the impact of SunRail, transparency on the commission, and other key issues in District 3. Later in the program, 90.7's Tom Parkinson speaks with political scientist Aubrey Jewett about some of the other Florida Senate and House races that are drawing statewide attention. That's coming up on Intersection Ballot 2012. You're listening to Intersection's Ballot 2012 series. I'm Mark Simpson. The race for Orange County Commissioner in District 3 has come to a runoff between former Orange County Commissioner Louis Damiani and former Orange County Administrator Pete Clark. The district has been without an elected commissioner since 2010 when Mildred Fernandez was removed after corruption charges. The boundaries of the East Orlando district were redrawn for 2012, reducing the Hispanic population a little bit, but it's still a strongly Hispanic district. Louis Damiani is an independent and was in the commissioner's seat put there by then-Governor Charlie Crist, but after a year and a half, Florida's new governor, Rick Scott, decided to replace him with John Martinez, son of former U.S. Senator Mel Martinez. Louis, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Pete Clark is a Republican, former county administrator. He campaigned for a seat on the commission 2 years ago, but ended up losing to Jennifer Thompson. Clark has lived in Orange County for close to 40 years, has a background in health administration. Pete, good to have you with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure being here. Thank you so much.
I want to start by talking about the makeup of the district itself. It has a large Latino population, but that has been reduced slightly by redistricting. Pete Clark, how would you go about making sure the interests of Latinos in the district are served well?
Well, what I continually tell everybody that we talk to and we knock on the door is that I'm going to be the same commissioner for each and every person. But what I will tell them is that everyone will have a seat at the table. When I do my appointments, I'm going to make sure it's reflective of the commission district and that everything is based on what is needed and based on the qualifications of the individual. And that resonates very well with everybody, including Latinos in the district. And what they really want at the end of the day is to make sure that they are represented. And my guarantee to them is I will represent them for the entire 4 years of my first term.
Louis Damiani, you were appointed in place of Commissioner Fernandez, and there was some complaint at that time from parts of the community who wanted a Latino representative to fill that seat. Do you think you were able to connect with the Hispanic community during your time as commissioner?
Yeah, I think there's no question about it. If you look at what we did on the day that I was appointed, I appointed a Hispanic outreach coordinator. All my staff that I appointed was bilingual, a Puerto Rican, a Venezuelan, and a Colombian. I even had a Mexican woman working for me for a while. And same thing, you know, I've made all 12 out of 18 of my appointments were Hispanics and or women. And as a result, last year I was named the Citizen of the Year by the Puerto Rican Association. I won the Aguila Award from the Hispanic Women Chamber of Commerce. This year I've been nominated for the Don Quixote Award, which is the most prominent award that you can win as a non-Hispanic, from the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. So I'm very proud of our accomplishments, and, we'll do more of the same.
Pete Clark, the county is being sued by a civil rights group that's unhappy about the dilution of the Latino vote under the reapportionment. How hard do you think it's going to be work for constituents who aren't necessarily pleased with the way that district's been redrawn?
Well, I think it's how you approach them and what you bring to the table. I think it's also about maybe having some sweat equity in the district. I've lived in Azalea Park. I've lived in South Goldenrod. I've put two clinics in the district over the years, one at Hoffner and Goldenrod, one at Underhill. In 436, I've created some after-school programs, which really helps parents, the kids that need to be after school so they can work. So I think when you can go to people and say, look, I have done these things over the years. I've done this for the entire community, but, it also helps the Latino community. And I think that when you connect with folks and they know that you have a genuine interest in what happens to them day to day, I think that's probably the key to it. And that's what the people know when I talk to them, that, I'm there for them. I've done things for them in the past, and it's not because I had to do them. It's because I wanted to do it. And I will continue to do that.
Louis, what are your thoughts on that lawsuit?
Well, I was there for the redistricting process and watched it. And frankly, the the opportunity to try to create a larger Hispanic population was very limited. I think that the job of the redistricting committee, I thought they did an outstanding job. The percentage point did go down a couple of points, but you know, we still salvaged the integrity of the district. To create a larger population would have required gerrymandering, which was exactly what the law says you cannot do. So, you know, in the end of the day, whether it's 41 out of 100 Hispanics that you end up representing, or 43 out of 100 Hispanics that you end up, it doesn't change how you represent the people. Certainly not the way I serve as commissioner. It doesn't change the way you represent. You represent everybody. You have to respect everybody's opinion, ethnicity, and make sure that you're reflective of that your appointments and everything you do is reflective of our community.
There's been a lot of recent controversy over text messages sent during the sick time debate at the Orange County Commission that raised some concerns over transparency in the commission. Louis, you're an independent, but you have strong business ties. You've already served on the commission, and you've pulled in tens of thousands of dollars in the last couple months from developers, real estate business, other interest groups. How, if elected, will you balance the needs of residents with those of folks lobbying the commission?
Well, first I would point out, to make the connection that it's been real estate and developers that have contributed to my campaign. If you look at my campaign reports, it's been all walks of life, people from retirees, doctors, lawyers, architects, engineers, the whole gamut of every type of occupation that's in this county. And I'm proud that so many people have stepped up and that I have the endorsement of the Chamber of Commerce and the home builders and the hoteliers. It's no coincidence that we have raised money from a broad spectrum of folks. As far as balancing the text, frankly, I never took my phone into the chamber. I never took my computer into the chamber when I was a commissioner. It's distracting. You are open and accessible to all the people, regardless of whether they or you should be if you're a commissioner, regardless of whether they contribute to their campaign. So, it's not a quid pro quo by any stretch of the imagination. I was the first one there in the morning, the last one to leave at night. There was never anybody that was turned down for a meeting with me. The job of a commissioner is to try to look at every single issue and balance those needs and make the best possible decision on behalf of the community.
Having seen that sick time debate unfold, what would you have done, if anything, differently?
Well, I would have voted to put the measure on the ballot. I mean, I'm proud to sit here and tell you that I've ran a grassroots campaign. I collected signatures to get my name put on the ballot. I collected more than 500 more than I needed and had them registered with the supervisor, and I did it a month early. So I've been knocking on doors since January. If somebody would have come and told me that now I can't participate, I can't have my name on the ballot after I went through and did everything I was supposed to do, that's just not the American way. It's not right. So certainly I would have voted to put the measure on the ballot.
Pete Clark, what are your thoughts watching the transparency concerns that were raised over that sick time debate on the Orange County Commission, and what, if anything, would you have done differently?
Well, I mean, as far as the text messaging, we used to live by the golden rule that, if you do something that's a public document, it's a public record, make sure you're addressing it to the editor, the Sentinel, or the news director. You don't want anything out there that you wouldn't want them to read. You really do have to be very, very careful as to how you use electronic media and electronic messaging. And the best thing to do is just not do it. And it's just that common. And like Louie, we knocked on thousands of doors. We got on the ballot via petition, and it is a lot of work. And even though I totally disagree with the ballot measure, I think that it's bad for business. I think there's an intrusion into business. I think it's placing Orange County government in a place they really do not want to be, and that is enforcing labor laws. That is not, in my mind, what a county government is there to do. It's there to protect the citizens and provide for infrastructure and probably the quality of life issues and leave those labor laws and those types of things to the federal and state government. So at the end of the day, I would have been struggling with it. I think the language in the second part was extraordinarily confusing about what a person would do if they missed work and it was under 15 employees. I think the language really did need to get cleaned up. But since they did collect 50,000 ballots, petitions, then I would have probably had to opt to vote for it to go. But I would strongly have opposed it.
Louis, with the follow-up.
I wanted to, I forgot, and Pete reminded me, I feel the same way. And I would have I would have put the measure on the ballot, and I would have at the time said that I will vehemently work against it. I don't believe it's the role of local government to mandate benefits for small businesses. I'm a small business owner, you know, myself, and my wife had a small advertising business, and, you know, we had enough government mandate, you know, just trying to run our business from day to day. So, you know, I concur with Pete wholeheartedly.
Louis, you're running on a platform of creating jobs and neighborhood revitalization. How specifically would you plan to do that?
Well, you know, we got to do several things, but we'll continue to do economic stimulus like we have done in the past. At least that would be, you know, my challenge. You know, I'm proud to tell you that when I was on the board that I voted to put an economic development tax initiative on, you know, on the tax abatement initiative on the ballot, which passed in January of this year. We funded, you know, literally, I think it was close to $1 million in incubator money. And other programs in collaboration with UCF and other agencies to try to create job training and small business assistance to try to create small business and help small business. I certainly will continue those efforts. You know, as far as urban revitalization, you know, the district that this District 3 is predominantly built out, it's older, it's antiquated. And in fact, the reason why now we even have a division that's called Neighborhood Preservation and Revitalization is because it was at my behest when Mayor Jacobs got there and I you know, articulated to her that we have to do something to protect and revitalize our older neighborhoods. So we've refocused a whole department to make that their effort. What I would do what I did on 436. I went and collaborated with the city of Orlando. We've started a Cimarron revitalization program. We now have it funded because of me. I went with Commissioner Ortiz, my colleague, partner in crime, the City of Orlando commissioner, and we went to the state. We were able to get $1.4 million appropriated for a program which has now since grown to $2.5 million, and you're beginning to see the revitalization efforts transpire down the 436 mm-hmm. corridor, and we need to do the same thing, South Orange Avenue, East Colonial, you know, other corridors in the district, and I'll work to do that.
Pete Clark, the county is placing an increased focus on research, medical, technology, simulation. There's new hospitals, the creation of the medical city. What would you do to drive investment in these fields to District 3?
That's a good question. In my background in medical, I think that I probably have an edge that with my contacts in the medical and so forth. And, you know, to my mind, the medical is going to be the next, the third leg of the stool. When you talk about simulation, tourism, the whole nine yards, medical city in itself is going to create, I believe, 20,000, 22,000 jobs over the next few years. And the estimate is that probably a quarter of those will start drifting back towards District 3. And I think I know with my medical background, we will start looking at those opportunities and integrate them into the small business efforts. And the revitalization will be a key to this, too, because people would want, you know, a reasonably good area to locate their business. But it all starts with public safety. None of this is going to mean a lick unless we have good, solid public safety and our citizens and our business people feel safe in their environment. And that's, as a commissioner, that's something I'm going to focus on from day one, is to make sure this all works because we have a safe environment for our family and our children so they can go shop in these places and they go to these medical entities. And I want these medical jobs because a person, without going to college, can make a phenomenal living if they go into the technical end of it, the trade end of it, the supply end. Medical is a huge consumer of goods and services, and the opportunities are endless, and I'll be there to do that.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm talking with former Orange County Commissioner Louis Damiani and former County Administrator Pete Clark, both candidates for Orange County Commission in District 3. I'm Mark Simpson. You can tell us about the issues that are important to you on Facebook and Twitter. Also, email us at intersection@wmfe.org. You had a brief follow-up?
Well, I just wanted to expound on what Pete was saying, and I agree with him wholeheartedly, and I think the other key element is that we need to, you know, be sure that we're working with our new businesses, in the medical profession and working in close synergy with our high schools and our colleges. We have, you know, tremendous academic facilities here in town, but there seems to sometimes be a disconnect between the end user, these companies that are going to be, you know, that have these science and technology needs and engineering needs in these new fields of simulation and green technologies and so forth. So, you know, we need to make sure that we have sort of a seamless passage for our students to be able to make it and be able to be prepared for those jobs.
Pete Clark, what is the most important thing that you would want to achieve by the end of your term if elected?
Well, I want two things. I want a safe community And I do this because I have, you know, a 21-year-old at UCF. I have a 16-year-old in school. I want them to be safe, but the other thing I want to have is opportunity for them in whatever field they want to choose. And there's a number of ways to get the economy going. And we've had these programs going for years and years and years, but like it or not, SunRail's coming down the track in District 3. And what's going to happen along the Orange Avenue corridor is the hospital is going to do some significant development. And I want to be there to make sure that from the county perspective that this spills over and continues down South Orange Avenue where it starts even into, you know, where it starts moving into the county side of it, and to do some development. And you can see development along Orange Avenue where they've come in and they've taken down old shopping centers, put up new shopping centers, new plazas. And that's what we need to do is continue to renovate and do vertical construction, infill projects. So at the end of my term, what I want to see are two corridors that are thriving. That would be the Orange Avenue corridor and the Cimarron corridor. And it's both city and county, so we can't just stop at the intersection of, you know, where the lines end. So two things, public safety. I want a safe community, the safest community we can possibly have. And you know we're the number one fatalities for pedestrians, and there's just things we really do need to address. And that's all in the public safety realm. That would include the sheriff, fire rescue, and emergency management. And I am certified in NEMS and emergency management, so I know how to do that. And the other is the creation of these business corridors to get the spillover from Medical City. So two things, a safe community and a vibrant community where new businesses are starting. And get government out of the way, make sure we're not interfering with the ability for them to thrive.
Louis Damiani, you've already had a little time on the commission, but in an elected term, what would be the most important thing you want to achieve by the end of that?
Well, I was actually there for 16 months. You know, let me talk about what I did. You know, I championed an ordinance to help our service-disabled veterans, and we were able to get that on the books. You know, two budget cycles, we were able to reduce spending. We were able to balance the county budget, reduce spending by $350 million, cut our impact fees by 25%. You know, I will continue to try to, reduce the scope, of government, try to keep, will not raise taxes, try to keep government in line with our citizens and with the same kind of cuts and reductions that we all are having to make at home, while at the same time focusing, just like Pete, on public safety. One of the programs that I created while there over the 2 years was the Goldenrod Safe Neighborhood Program. We designated an area where we implemented this program, citizen-based program. But now, in that area, when a criminal is caught, we levy an extra fine on that criminal when he goes through the court system. That money stays back in the area and pays for additional deputies, boots on the street in those areas. And that we were able to do without creating any new taxes. It's lumped straight back on the criminals who create the crime. And those are kind of innovative thinking. That's the kind of innovative thinking that we need to be able to tackle crime issues.
Pete, you mentioned SunRail coming down Orange Ave and the I-4 corridor area. What do you see as challenges in the future as SunRail comes into the district and fully expands?
A couple challenges. One is we need to make sure the residents are protected from the noise. I mean, this is a huge issue down the South Orange Avenue, and I'm going to be a proponent of the quiet zones for them, and that's, of course, going to be some county expense, but I think it's a small price to pay for having these folks not having to be disturbed by these trains. The thing that concerns me, though, is that last mile, they call it, is when they get off the train, what do we do with them? You know, we have no dedicated funding for links. We have a bus system that we need to really make sure that it's there as well in other modes of transportation to get the folks off.
Is there something you'd be able to do to help funding for links?
Well, there's a couple things I want to look at. One, there's two areas I think we can reduce the budget. One is in the DJJ costs that we pay the state for the kids that are put in the detention center. I think there's an opportunity to reduce that by $2-3 million. We're paid $200-some-odd a day per kid. The other is employee health care. Without reducing the benefits to the employees, we've never gone to on-site medical care and pharmacy care for employees, which could be a 10-15% reduction. Those two combined could be $4-6 million a year. My mind has put that in an account now. It's kind of like the Dave Ramsey theory. You have an envelope. We'll put this in the SunRail envelope. In 7 years, when the bill becomes due, then we're not going to be throwing our hands up in the air saying, where will we get the money, at least for the O&M piece of it. So if you have the peace of mind that the O&M is taken care of, then we need to look at the link situation. You know, I've been a proponent of, you know, the surcharge, and when I was doing my interview with a business force, they didn't think that was going to fly, but I still never give up on something. I think we still need to push the surcharge for rental cars, dedicate that to links, and smaller buses, get the transit system going. But this SunRail, the stations, we need a link to the east side. because if we want people to be able to come to all sorts, all parts of the district, we need to be able to move them between the two major corridors so that they can enjoy some prosperity and some jobs.
Louis Damiani, looking ahead at that same question of SunRail coming into the district as it expands and other public transit options like Lynx, what would you try to do, and do you see any challenges ahead?
Clearly funding for the transit system is we don't have a dedicated funding source, as Pete mentioned. I fully support the rental car surcharge is what they call it. And essentially what that is an extra $2 fee that's lumped onto rental cars. So, again, not on the back of our taxpayers, but on the 55 million visitors that we have coming into this community every year. If we could get the legislature and, you know, I mean, in it, there's a nuance to be able to develop the relationships with your peers. And by the way, I've earned the endorsement of every member of our city council, with the exception of one, including Mayor Dyer, and several of our school board members and other people, other elected leaders in our community. And what that shows is my ability to develop those kinds of relationships, with our peers. And I think that we need to work with our legislative delegation, make that a priority, so that we have a dedicated funding source to be able to provide better, more reliable headways and, transit opportunities. I also think there's a tremendous, tremendous opportunity for us down, particularly at the Sand Lake Station, with transit-oriented development and developing a whole master plan for that area where we can revitalize the South Orange Corridor and create pedestrian-friendly opportunities where people can get off the trains and be able to go shopping and have apartments and things within walking distance that we just don't have.
There is talk about trying to expand rail in that area, connecting the Sand Lake Station to the airport, maybe through a monorail or something along those lines that could also go to Medical City.
Absolutely.
Do you support something like that?
Absolutely, 100%. We have to have that connection, and eventually it'll happen. I believe I voted in favor of SunRail. I'm proud of that. When I came to this town, we had 800,000 people, I think, 25 years ago. And, now we're at 1.2 million. The people aren't going to slow down, and we can only widen the road so much that we have to have transit opportunities.
Pete, that same question, some sort of maybe monorail linking up Sand Lake area, Medical City, is that something you would support as well to the airport?
I think it's critical we do that and we move it further down south. I mean, if you want to really move the tourists, and you go to major cities, if you get off the airplane, I mean, you can go somewhere in that airport and you can miraculously appear where you need to be, and I'd like D.C. and some of the other cities. And, we can't do subways, of course, but regardless of the mode, I think we do need to connect the airport. Medical City would be awesome to connect that. It would really expand the ability to do services. And then if there ever is a link between here and Tampa, which, if we get the privates to do it, that would be good, then we really connect the entire area and it would be just a good economic area. And the development along the rail, the hospital is going to do some major, major development, and it's going to be a mixed use. Back is now an industrial area, and that will be an example of what we could see on down the road as this thing unfolds.
We know that the city and the county both want to go forward on renovating the Citrus Bowl. There's also talk, though, about renovating the Orange County Convention Center. Which of those do you think should be a higher priority, Louis Damiani?
Wow, higher priority. I mean, they are both a priority. I guess I would say that the convention center should be if push came to shove, because the convention center is the golden goose. I mean, it is, we have one of the biggest convention centers in the world. When we do a major show, the economic impact to this community is tremendous. It is the generator of the tourist tax that is what fuels and pays for actually the renovations of the Citrus Bowl. So, I mean, chicken and egg theory. So you got to have the money first, in order to do the other.
Pete Clark, any difference on approach to that, Citrus Bowl versus Convention Center?
No, I mean, without the Convention Center, then we don't get the tourist tax. So, it's kind of the same deal, is that if you want to do it, we need to fill the bedrooms the hotel rooms and get the tourist tax coming in.
I've been speaking with candidates for Orange County Commission District 3. We've been talking with former Orange County Administrator Pete Clark and former Orange County Commissioner Lou Damiani. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. Good to speak with you.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Up next, University of Central Florida political scientist Aubrey Jewett talks with 90.7's Tom Parkinson about fierce competition for some of the Florida House and Senate seats that are up for grabs this November. In the Florida legislature, there are lots of races, both for state House and Senate, that are garnering attention statewide. 90.7's Tom Parkinson spoke with University of Central Florida political scientist Aubrey Jewett about some of the most interesting contests. They started with State House District 29.
Representative Chris Dorworth, he's already been named the incoming House Speaker, but he's facing, you know, a surprisingly tough challenge from Democrat Mike Cleland.
Yeah, and this is a race where, again, on paper, Republicans have an advantage. It's a district that has about an 8% registration advantage for Republicans. And, of course, when you have someone that's already the Speaker designate, that means that they're going to draw a lot of money to the race because everybody wants to get in good with whoever they think is going to be in charge of the House, quite frankly. But it's turned out so far, I think, to be a more competitive race than people suspected, mainly because Dorworth's got some baggage. He's got some personal financial baggage. He's a developer, and like many people who are in Florida development, he's taken a bath financially. I mean, I think his house is in foreclosure. You know, he's got a negative net worth right now. And, you know, that's just he's just going through a very rough time. And, of course, the rap from Democrats and other people who are critical of him say, you know, is that somebody that we should have not only representing us, but also the head of the whole House of Representatives?
Now, one of the state Senate races here in Central Florida that's been attracting a lot of attention is Senate District 8, covering Volusia County, as well as parts of Lake and Marion counties. You have Representative Dorothy Huekill from Port Orange and Democrat Frank Bruno. And this is another race where a lot of outside money has been pouring in.
Oh, yeah, definitely. This is considered to be one of the premier competitive races for the Senate in Florida this cycle. The district, when it was redrawn, has about a 3% Democratic edge in registration, but it's fairly tight. And you certainly have two very well-known and what political scientists would say quality candidates, because they both have held political office before, they both know how to raise money, they both know how to organize campaigns, and they both have good name recognition going into this. So that is why you have seen, if you live anywhere in Central Florida, you have seen a lot of ads being spent on television, you've heard them on the radio, and if you live in that district, you've gotten a lot of direct mail pieces as well, you know, hundreds of thousands. In fact, I wouldn't be shocked if over a million is spent on this state Senate race by the time it's all over. I mean, and perhaps more than a million.
That's just an amazing amount of money for a state race, for a state, even state Senate.
Oh, absolutely. And it's mostly, you know, some of it is campaign money directly that's coming from the candidates themselves. But a lot of it is outside interest or the political parties themselves. But the Republican Party of Florida and the Democratic Party of Florida have been running a lot of ads. And, of course, quite a few of the ads have been negative, trying to, for instance, the Republicans have outspent currently Democrats a little bit. So you've seen a lot of ads hammering Bruno for his time as county executive in Volusia about, you know, maybe taxes going up or overall Volusia County having a higher tax rate than most counties or things like that.
One of the reasons that these Central Florida legislative races are so closely watched and considered so important is because the outcomes here could impact the balance of power in the legislature in Tallahassee, or at least in the Senate.
Well, yes. And I might add, realistically, for the Democrats to take over the House, it would pretty much take a miracle. The Senate is, you know, Republicans still have a better chance of holding the Senate, but I think that's where Democrats have at least a shot. And really, for Democrats, realistically, it's even if they can't take control, it's about actually having a little more relevance. Because right now, Republicans are just so far ahead. It's like 28-12 in the Senate and maybe 81-39 or 80-40 in the House. Democrats really just can't stop anything. I mean, they just can't. But if they could gain two or three seats in the Senate, if they could take it over, that'd be better for them. But if they could just gain two or three seats in the Senate, maybe 5-10 seats in the House, they would at least be a minority party that could do something in the legislature.
That's Aubrey Jewett, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, speaking with 90.7's Tom Parkinson. You can hear much more of Tom Parkinson's conversation with Professor Aubrey Jewett online, discussing state legislative races, along with more of our Ballot 2012 political coverage at WMFE.org/intersection and WMFE.org/election. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Our production team includes Amy Green and Matthew Petty. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.